Accession number 14197, rail 1.
This is Mr. Orville Schleff, rail 1. And if I could ask you first of all, Mr. Schleff, something about your background. Could you tell me where you were born?
I was born here right in St. Louis. And I came back to live here because we liked it. When I was drafted into the Army, I went to Camp McQuaid, California.
Before you went into the Army, could you tell me something about your family life? This would be before the war.
Yeah, before the war, Dad worked as a night watchman for William R. Warner. I worked for International Shoe Company for a while, and then they fired me when the war came along because they were afraid I was going to be drafted as so many of the other younger people there. And they were right, but I went to work for Etiquette Johnson Shoe Company after that, and I worked for was working for Etiquette Johnson when I was drafted. And they not only held my job for me, but every year that I was in the service, they sent me a check for my vacation pay. And they told me my job was still safe and I could come back when I wanted to. So after the, that was my work experience was all with Shoe Company, International, Endicott Johnson, and later Brown Shoe. I got a total of 43 years in the shoe industry.
Could I go back to this period, you know, before the war started? Did you know what was going on in Europe? Did you have any idea of what Hitler...
Yes, but we didn't pay too much attention to it here because we didn't think we would ever be involved in it. And my father served during World War I in the United States Marine Corps. And my brother, before I was drafted... he decided he wanted to be a Marine, so he graduated from high school at 8 o'clock in the evening, and at 9 o'clock the next morning he was on a train heading for California. And he spent 20 years in the Marine Corps. In between, he went back to New Zealand, where he met his wife, and she married him back there with the promise that when he got out of the Corps, they would go, if her parents were still alive, they would go back to New Zealand. So when he retired from the Marine Corps, about 1962-65, somewhere along in there, he retired, her parents were still alive, and they moved back to the family homestead in Auckland, New Zealand.
This period before the war, you know, it's interesting what you were saying, that you didn't feel America would be involved.
We in our family at least, we didn't pay much attention to it until our boys started being drafted, and then we began to worry about it.
Yes, would that have been after Pearl Harbor?
Yes.
Could you tell me about Pearl Harbor? And how you reacted to that? Had you perceived any threat, for instance, coming from Japan?
No. We didn't pay any attention. Because being Americans, as we are, we thought the world rose and set in our own backyard. And the heck with what the rest of the world was doing. And along came the war, and we didn't really know what to do. Then Pearl Harbor started it all off, and I wasn't there. I've never been there, but my brother has, and because he served in the Pacific Theater during the war. He was at Tarawa, Saipan, Okinawa, and some other place. But he was a radio operator and went ashore with the first landing troops. In all four of the operations, though, he never once was injured. They sent him back off the front lines because of his hay fever, and then sent him right back. He says, "Hell, I went back into the same foxhole I came out of."
So how did you react to the draft, you know, when you heard that you had...
Well, I'll tell you, the man that hired me at Etika Johnson hired me, and he told me the day I left, he says, "I hired you because I took one look at you and I figured the Army would never want a scrawny little individual like this, so I'm safe in hiring him." But the Army, 9 months later, took me anyhow. And when I got into the Army, they issued me a pair of shoes that was about three sizes too large, and I complained very bitterly about that. And they said, "Yeah, you'll grow into them." And when I got to Camp McQuaid, I went on sick call because my shoes were hurting, and I have to take two steps before the shoes would move. And a colonel there examined me, and he says, "Your shoes are too large. You need a smaller pair." I said, "That's what I've been telling him." He says, "I'll fix it." So he got me the right size shoes. But they were more interested in my mouth than they were with my feet. Because in one of the things I did was go to the first session of St. Louis Junior College, which was held in Harris Teachers College at the time. And I was playing corkball on the tennis court, and the catcher and I ran in. I was pitching. Catcher and I ran into each other going after a pop-up, not paying attention to where we were going. And he was a little shorter than me, so I hit him across the forehead with my open mouth hollering, "I got it, I got it," and boy, I got it. He spent a day home from school, and I spent 10 days in the hospital because I had 8 teeth knocked out of my mouth up into my gums, and it had shattered my jawbone, and you can see up here, there is a piece of bone coming through, and the dentist said, "We're not going to do anything with that. If it doesn't bother you, don't worry about it." So, I didn't have my denture at the time. The dentist put the teeth back where they had been, or approximately. And when I reported to the Army, my dentist said, "You tell anybody that wants to work on your mouth that they must first x-ray everything in the front of your mouth, because if they don't, they're going to shatter the jawbone again." So I went home, and my brilliant uncle brought me peanut brittle to eat in the hospital when I couldn't have anything to eat or drink. Everything was through a glass straw. But I survived that, got into the Army with these, what they call drifting teeth. There were times when I could slip a half dollar in between my two front teeth, and other times I couldn't even get a piece of paper between them. Because you couldn't see them move, but you could see that they had moved. And so the first thing I did with my discharge money was take it down to the dentist and say, "Hey, Doc, get rid of these and get me a denture." And I'm still wearing that same denture. The dentist that I saw about 2 months ago could hardly believe that I was wearing the denture that long, but it has. Now, I've got three teeth out on the bottom because she pulled some bad ones that had in them.
Going back to the Army, when you, you know, went in and they sorted, you know, your teeth out for you, what unit were you in?
Once I got overseas, I was with the Western Base Section, which was the headquarters unit that was stationed there in Chester. Later, after we went over to France, they changed it to something else, and I can't remember what it was. Yeah, but it was the same group that we had together in England that transferred over to France as a group, and I was with the reserve detachment, I guess you would call it. And we closed up the office in England, and then the 10 of us had to wangle our own transportation to France to meet our headquarters, which was then stationed in Le Havre.
But were you in the infantry? Would that have been an infantry group?
No, it wasn't. It was a completely non-combat group. And while we were in France during the Battle of the Bulge, I got orders transferring me to an infantry group. And I showed them to my colonel, and he says, "The hell they will. They're not going to take my top man in his office." So Sergeant Schaefer and I both, he called Paris, and he called a general down there, called him by his first name. They'd gone to West Point together.
Perhaps I could ask you about that when we go to France, could
okay.
I? If I could keep to this early part. Did the group you were with, did it have a number or a name that
no.
we could identify?
No. Yes, it was the 101st Artillery Training Battalion, Coast Artillery Training Battalion.
Right.
Because in our training, we fired 6-inch guns, 155 millimeter. But there again, we took our basic training, which involved a lot of marching, and the guys would all come back pooped out. And yours truly was just getting started, because my job here at the time had been, with International Shoe Company, had been a mail boy at the Broadway and Cherokee plant, which was their biggest establishment in St. Louis. And I walked 17 miles a day on the job, and I rode to and from work on a bicycle, which was another 20 miles, 10 miles each way on a bicycle. And on Wednesday and Friday, I walked from my home to my church, which is a distance of about 5 miles. And so these hikes didn't bother me at all. The other guys would be winded and exhausted, and I would just barely be getting up a wind. And frequently, during basic training, after marching all day, I would dress in my Class A uniform and walk into Watsonville, California, which was the closest town, and that was about 5 miles. So I got a lot of walking, and that's why this thing is killing me now, because I have to walk with the walker since I had a stroke back in May. And I went to get out of bed in the morning and nearly fell flat on my face. But
did you know anything about the war, you know, once you had joined up? You know, for instance, were you told about events in Europe? You knew England had been in the war, I suppose,
yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, we knew all about the war, although we wanted to push it out of our minds. Nonetheless, it was there, and we were drafted and had to go into it. Yes, we knew what was happening in Europe, and we knew basically what the government wanted to tell us, because we were pretty well indoctrinated in the Army with public relations between Army troops and civilians. But I had applied in basic training for OCS in the communication, because I had been a ham radio operator, although I never got a license. I talked with my brother, who made it his profession, and I tried to get into the Signal Corps OCS, which was the unit that handled their radios, and I passed the exam, but I didn't get selected for Signal Corps OCS because there were too many men involved. So the next thing I knew was I was at Camp Shenango, Pennsylvania, and had a little training there. I went to Camp Shanks, New York, and the next thing I knew I was on the Queen Mary heading east. And I was on the run that the Mary made. It was the largest passenger capacity that was ever carried on that ship. And we ate lunch. Seemed like we were always in line. We were either in line to go to lunch, to go to chow, or in line to go to our stateroom. We slept on the deck one night and in the stateroom another. And we made the trip in 3 days and three nights and landed at Greenock, Scotland. And, of course, the guys that was with then were none of the guys that I had taken basic training with, because they had been assigned to other units.
Well, during that three-day journey, did you suffer any air or sea threat from the enemy?
No. They wouldn't even try to hit the Mary because she went too fast. And later the Elizabeth was the same way. They traveled up. You could feel the ship list as they changed direction, because they went in a zigzag course all the way across, and still took only 3.5 days. But
how crowded was that ship then? With so
many
it
people? Was crowded. There were troops lay sleeping on the tennis courts on the upper decks. We were on the promenade deck, and we slept one night there. And then the next night, we slept in bunks in a stateroom, where they had just built the bunks in, and I think they had 12 of us in the one stateroom. So we were practically laying in each other's face when we went to bed in there. And of course, we had no showers. The only shower water was salt water, and one guy got in and soaped up, and then they turned on the salt water. I don't think he ever got the soap off of him. But
what sort of kit were you provided with for going overseas? Your uniform and kit?
Well, because we were going to England, they gave us what they call a Class A uniform, which was basically a brown serge outfit. It was pretty warm. When I got into England, they issued us fatigues, which is a light green-colored uniform. But most of the time in England, we wore Class A uniforms, and when we got into England, the boat docked in Scotland, in Greenock, Scotland, and then they put us on a train like a herd of cattle, and the next thing we knew, we were in Birmingham at a replacement depot, and from Birmingham, they sent me to Chester, and I spent all the rest of my time with the Western Base Section headquarters in Chester, England.
What time of year would you have arrived in England?
I got there in about May of 93, but I know what it was, 1942.
Yes, can you remember your first impressions, you know, on that journey from Scotland to Birmingham? What did you think of the country that you were passing through?
Well, all we saw there were not very much, really. When we saw houses, we saw backyards. Because in England at that time, and I think still, the trains run in a depressed area, and all you could see was the puff of smoke as the train went by. You couldn't see the train itself. Now they have all diesels, so you see a little wisp of smoke, but you still don't see the train. I went back and visited when my daughter went to school over there in 1975, I think it was, and spent a couple of months, a couple of days there. We went to London, landed there, stayed in a hotel, and then we toured London on a bus. And then we went up to Harlaxton Manor, which was the name of the school, and we spent 3 days there. But I left, my wife and my daughter and myself, we left after we had been there only one day, and we went over to Chester to see the Furnival family, with whom I had spent a lot of time as a soldier. And Mrs. Furnival was dead, but Mr. Furnival broke into tears and cried when I came in. He thought he would never have seen me again. And really, it was odd that he did. If my daughter hadn't elected to go to Harlaxton at Grantham, why, I would never have been back to England as
did
it
you,
was.
Yes. Did you find the country much altered, you know, from your impressions, going back to 1942, your impressions
most
then?
Most of the alterations were in the area of the railroads. They were all diesel operated in 75, as opposed to all being steam operated in 1942. But I like the idea of the depressed roadway for the railroad, because it made for very few grade crossings. You crossed over the railroad on a bridge. And one of my guys came home one night, soaking wet, came back out to camp at Vickers Cross. And we said, what in the world happened to you? He said, well, it was foggy as usual. And he was riding his bicycle, and he turned on what he thought was Bridge Street, but it was Water Street. And he rode smack into the canal and didn't know it. And I did a lot of bicycling in England.
Yes, so let me ask you now, you know, after this journey to Birmingham and then to Chester, could you tell me about your camp, your base, where you were based? And if we keep to the camp, first of all, before you tell me about your experiences, what sort of camp it was?
It was a camp made up of Nissen huts and a couple of buildings that were on the estate when the United States Army took it over. And the officers lived catty-cornered across the road in officers' quarters, but those were also Nissen huts. So I learned all about Nissen huts in England, because we had a tornado and came through the place one night and ripped all of the outer sheeting off of half a dozen of our huts. And I woke up in the morning, and here was all this metal laying on the ground. And I said, hey, guys, what happened? And they said, you slept through it all, Sarge. But we had a tornado last night that tore all the sheeting off the huts. And you didn't even bat an eye. And I can still sleep the same way. So I slept through the big tornado. But one of the things that we had a great big Nissen hut that we made to a latrine with toilets and showers. And we had showers. We had a hot water heater that ran through the furnace room, and it frequently heated the water so hot the steam came out of the tank outside. But we kind of enjoyed it.
Did you do further training in England? You know, what were you actually doing within this camp?
In England, I was assigned to the Provost Marshal's office, and they sat me in front of a typewriter, and I said, I don't know how to type. They said, you're going to learn. So I learned to type with these two fingers about 110 words a minute, and which I understand is pretty good. But I was typing delinquent reports on men who had gone AWOL from their outfits, and our MPs, which came under the Provost Marshal office, was looking for them. So I spent a great deal of my time typing up delinquent reports.
Were there many of them?
Huh?
Were there many reports of people?
Oh, there were plenty of reports. The guys were going AWOL right and left. And
does that mean that discipline was a bit loose?
That meant they wanted to see the country. And we did, too. I learned to go up to Liverpool and up there catch the train and go on up to up near Blackpool. And there was a Red Cross station up there, and we went up there for a weekend. That was before I got to know my civilian friends in town.
And what was your impression, you know, when you went to places like Liverpool and Blackpool?
I thought it was old-fashioned. They had running water in the back kitchen, but in what they called the kitchen, there wasn't any running water. That's where they did their cooking. So So things were carried back and forth from the back kitchen to the kitchen to cook and to eat. It was, they had motor buses. Chester had no trams. But in Liverpool, they had trams. We learned to ride them over there. And then when we got over on the continent, of course, we rode them in Lille and Brussels. But by and large, the country was just kind of, it seemed to us like a small town. Even though Chester was one of the major cities, which I didn't know at the time, but I learned later. And when we went into the town, went to church on Sunday. And I tried several churches because the Baptist church in Chester didn't seem like my Baptist church here. But the Church of Christ in Chester was almost a twin to the church that I went to here. So I went to the Church of Christ regularly, and there I met the Furnival family. And he was not in the army because he was a telephone serviceman and was held back. He was out climbing poles, and I went with him frequently in a little van, a little lorry that he drove. And we climbed telephone poles because he knew I was interested in communications. I went along with him. Later, he and I together bought a tandem bicycle up in Liverpool. The first time I had ever been on one. We rode from Liverpool down to Chester to get that thing home. He kept it most of the time because I had my own roadster bike. But every once in a while, one of my friends at camp would want to go for a bike ride. He didn't have a bike, so I'd go into town and get the tandem, and I taught him how to ride tandems. Of course, I had to learn myself because the first time we rounded a corner, I threw both of us off the bike because I swung in, not used to being a long tandem, and I caught the rear handlebars on a telephone, a light standard, and it dumped us off. But we covered many miles on that, Walt Furnival and myself, and it was through him that we went to his brother's farm down in Wales for an Easter Sunday. And I had a whole quart of whipped cream all to myself, real whipped cream. And we rode the tandem back to camp, and I was sicker than a dog. So I reported over to the dispensary, and they shoved me in a bed, and I was in the bed for 3 days. And the doctor said, "Sergeant, what the hell did you eat?" I said, "A quart of whipped cream." He says, "Real whipped cream?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, you know, you've been over here for about a year and haven't had any milk products. So you shouldn't have eaten whipped cream. But if I had a chance to eat whipped cream, I'd be right there in the bed alongside of you." And so I didn't eat whipped cream. Whipped cream and grape cake. I had never had grape cake before. I have had it since, but I don't eat the seeds.
What did you think of the of living standards of the British people you met? Did you think it was very different from America at that time, with the wartime rationing and things?
Well, in a way it was different because they didn't have the things to eat that we had. And when I would go to spend a weekend at the Furnivals after I left camp, I always arranged with my mess sergeant to take food along with me. And I brought them the first butter. They had two kids, a little boy who was 9 and his sister was 12. They had never had butter in their life, and I brought butter. Bananas, had never had a banana in their life, and I brought them bananas. They had to teach them how to peel them and eat them. As the little guy was, Ron was his name, he was ready to dive in and eat skin and all. I said, "No, you peel it first and throw that part away." But otherwise, you know, they had one-dish meals, but I was used to that because my family was very poor, not very well off. We never had an automobile. I had used a friend's car here while I was in St. Louis. And That was how I got into the motor pool end of the thing over there, driving the trucks around. And while I was in school here, I learned to run a movie projector. So I could do almost anything with the 35 millimeter projectors that they put into the king-size Nissan hut that they use for our theater. One experience I had was with the 16 millimeter. I took it down to the Red Cross Club and operated it one evening. Well, I operated it for a whole week. And next night, one night in the next week, I was just sitting minding my own business when the sergeant called me and said, "Schlepp, we need somebody to run the projectors. Come on over to the theater." So I got over to the theater and I threaded the things up like you do a 16 millimeter projector.